it because canceling his plan would have cost more than continuing it. Plus, there were times he really needed it. Reacher told him this was one of those times. He told him to call a cab. Shevik said he couldn't afford a cab. Reacher told him yes he could, just this once. The cab that came was an old beat-up Crown Vic, thick with orange peel paint, with a cop car spotlight on the driver's pillar and a taxi light strapped to the roof. Not an appealing vehicle visually, but it worked okay. It wallowed and whined the mile to Shevik's house and pulled up outside. Reacher helped Shevik down the narrow concrete path to his door. Once again, it opened before the guy could get his key in the lock. Mrs. Shevik stared out at him. There were silent questions in her face. A taxi? For your knee? Then why did the big man come back, too? And above all, do we owe another $1,000? It's complicated again, Shevik said. They went back to the kitchen. The stove was cold. No dinner. They had already eaten once that day. They all sat down at the table. Shevik told his part of the story. No Fiznik, a substitute instead, a sinister pale stranger with a big black book. Then Reacher's offer to be a go-between. Mrs. Shevik switched her gaze to Reacher, who said, I'm pretty sure he was Ukrainian. He had a prison tattoo on his neck. Cyrillic alphabet, certainly. I don't think Fiznik was Ukrainian, Mrs. Shevik said. Fiznik is an Albanian name. I looked it up at the library. He said Fiznik had been replaced. He said whatever business anyone had with Fiznik, now they had it with him. He said Fiznik's clients were now his clients. He said if you owed money to Fiznik, now you owed it to him. He made the same kind of point several times over. He said it wasn't rocket science. Did he want another $1,000? He propped his book open so close to his chest, it was awkward. At first, I wasn't sure why. I assumed he didn't want me to see what was in it. He asked my name, and I said Aaron Shevik. He looked down at his book and nodded, which I thought was weird. Why? What were the odds the book happened to be propped open at the S page? 1 in 26. Possible, but unlikely. So then I started to think he was hiding the book not because he didn't want me to see what was in it, but because he didn't want me to see what wasn't in it, because there was nothing in it. It was blank. That was my guess. Then he proved it. He asked me how much I owed. He didn't know. He didn't have Fiznik's previous data. It wasn't Fiznik's old ledger. It was a new blank book. What does all that mean? It means this wasn't a routine internal reorganization. They didn't bench Fiznik and send in a pinch hitter. It was a hostile takeover from the outside. There's a whole new management now. I went back through the guy's words, his use of language. He made it clear. Someone else is muscling in. Wait, Mrs. Shevik said. I heard it on the radio. Last week, I think. We're getting a new police commissioner. He says we have rival Ukrainian and Albanian gangs in town. Reacher nodded. There you go, he said. The Ukrainians are moving in on a part of the Albanians' business. You're dealing with new people now. Did they want the extra $1,000? They're looking ahead, not back in the past. They're prepared to write off Fiznik's old loans, all or part, because they have to. They have no choice. They don't know what anyone owes. They don't have the information. And why wouldn't they write it off anyway? It wasn't their money. They want his customers. That's all. For the future. They want to service their needs for the next many years. Did you pay the man? He asked what I owed, and I took a chance and told him $1,400. He looked down at his blank page and nodded solemnly and agreed. So I paid him $1,400, at which point he said I was good to go. And he confirmed I was paid off in full.
Where's the rest of the money?
Right here, Reacher said. He took the envelope out of his pocket, barely thinner than it was before. Still 211 bills in it, $21,100. He put it on the table in the middle, equidistant. Shevik and his wife stared at it and said nothing. Reacher said, "This is a random universe. Once in a blue moon, things turn out just right. Like now, someone started a war. And you're the exact opposite of collateral damage." Shevik said, "Not if Fiznik shows up next week wanting all this plus $7,000 more." "He won't," Reacher said. "Fiznik has been replaced, which, coming from a Ukrainian gangster with prison ink on his neck, almost certainly means Fiznik is dead, or otherwise incapacitated. He won't be showing up next week, or any week. And you're all squared away with the new guys. They said so. You're out of the woods." There was silence for a long moment. Mrs. Shevik looked at Reacher. "Thank you," she said. Then Shevik's cell phone rang. He limped out to the hallway and took the call. Reacher heard a faint plastic quack from the earpiece. A man's voice, he thought. He couldn't make out the words. Some long stream of information. He heard Shevik reply, loud and clear, 10 feet away, with a muttered assent that sounded weary and unsurprised, yet still disappointed. Then Shevik asked what was unmistakably a question. He said, "How much?" The faint plastic quack answered. Shevik closed his phone. He stood still for a moment, and then he limped back into the kitchen and sat down again at the table. He folded his hands in front of him. He looked at the envelope. Not a stare, not a gaze. Some kind of a bittersweet glance. Equidistant, equally far away from all of them. He said, "They need another $40,000. His wife closed her eyes and clamped her hands over her face. Reacher said, "Who needs?" "Not Fiznik," Shevik said. "Not the Ukrainians either. Not any of them. This is the other end of the issue entirely. This is the reason we had to borrow money in the first place." "Are you being blackmailed?" "No, nothing like that. I wish it was that simple. All I can say is there are bills we have to pay. One just came due. Now we have to find another $40,000. He glanced at the envelope again. "Some of which we've already got, thanks to you." He worked it out in his head. "Technically, we need to find another $18,900. By when?"
"Tomorrow morning."
"Can you?"
"We couldn't find another 18 cents.
"Why so quick?"
"Some things can't wait."
"What are you going to do?" Shevik didn't answer. His wife took her hands away from her face.
"We're going to borrow it," she said.
"What else can we do?" "Who from?" "The man with the prison tattoo," she said. "What choice do we have? We're maxed out everywhere else." "Can you pay it back?"
"We'll cross that bridge when we come to it."
No one spoke. Reacher said, "I'm sorry, I can't help you more." Mrs. Shevik looked at him.
"You can," she said.
"Can I?"
"In fact, you'll have to."
"Will I?"
"The man with the prison tattoo thinks you're Aaron Shevik. You have to go get our money for us."
Chapter 7. They discussed it 30 minutes more, Reacher and the Sheviks, back and forth. Certain facts were established early, the fixed points, the deal breakers. They absolutely needed the money, no question, no debate. They absolutely needed it by morning, no leeway, no flexibility. They absolutely would not say why. Their life savings were gone. Their house was gone. They were newly into an old person's mortgage arrangement, whereby they were allowed to live there the rest of their lives, but the title had already passed to the bank.
The lump sum they had gotten was already spent. No more could be raised. Their credit cards were maxed out and canceled. They had borrowed against their Social Security checks. They had cashed in their life insurance and given up their landline telephone. Now that their car was gone, they had sold everything of value. All they had left were personal trinkets. Between their own stuff and family heirlooms, they had 5 9-carat wedding bands, 3 small diamond rings, and a gold-plated wristwatch with a crack in the crystal. Reacher figured on the happiest day of his life, the most warm-hearted pawnbroker in the world might have given them $200. No more than that. Maybe less than 100 on a bad day. Not even a drop in the bucket. They said they had first used Fiznik 5 weeks previously. They had gotten his name from a neighbor, as an item of gossip, not as a recommendation. Some kind of a scandal. Some lurid story about some other neighbor's nephew's wife's cousin borrowing money from a gangster in a bar. Name of Fiznik, imagine that. Shevik had narrowed the search radius based on detail and rumor, and he had started checking every bar within that predicted area one by one, blushing, embarrassed, stared at, asking every barman if he knew a guy named Fiznik, until at his fourth stop a fat man with a sarcastic manner jerked his thumb at the corner table. Reacher said, "How did it work?"
"Very easy," Shevik said. "I approached his table and stood there while he inspected me. And then he signaled me to sit down, so I did. I guess at first I beat about the bush a bit, but then I just came out and said, 'Look, I need to borrow money, and I understand you lend it.' He asked how much, and I told him. He explained the terms of the contract. He showed me the photographs. I watched the video. I gave him my account number. 20 minutes later, the money was in my bank. It was wired in from somewhere untraceable via a corporation in Delaware." "I pictured a bag of cash," Reacher said. "We had to make our repayments in cash." Reacher nodded. "Two things in one," he said, "both at the same time. Loan sharking and money laundering. They wired dirty electrons, and in return, they got random clean cash from the streets. Plus a healthy rate of interest on top. Most money laundering involves losing a percentage, not gaining one. I guess those boys weren't dumb. Not in our experience." "You think the Ukrainians will be better or worse?"
"Worse, I expect. The law of the jungle seems to be proving it already."
"So how are you going to pay them back?"
"That's tomorrow's problem."
"You have nothing left to sell."
"Something might show up."
"In your dreams?"
"No, in reality.
We're waiting for something. We have reason to believe it will come very soon.
We have to hang tough until it does."
They absolutely would not say what they were waiting for. 20 minutes later, Reacher stepped down the far curb unencumbered and crossed the street in 4 fast strides and stepped up the near curb and pulled the bar door. Inside, it felt brighter than before because it was darker outside, and it was a click noisier because there were more people, including a group of 5 men all squeezed around a 4-top table, all reminiscing about something or other. The pale guy was still in the far back corner. Reacher walked toward him. The pale guy watched him all the way. Reacher dialed it back a little. There were conventions to follow. Lender and borrower. He walked what he thought of as his friendly walk. Pure, unselfconscious locomotion. No threat to anybody. He sat down in the same chair he had used before. The pale guy said,
"Erenshevik, right?"
"Yes," Reacher said.
"What brings you back so soon?"
"I need a loan."
"Already? You just paid me off."
"Something came up."
"I told you," the guy said. "Losers like you always come back."
"I remember," Reacher said.
"How much do you want?"
$18,900, Reacher said. The pale guy shook his head.
Can't do it, he said.
Why not?
It's a big jump up from 800 last time.
1400.
600 of that was fees and charges. The capital sum was 800 only.
That was then. This is now. It's what I need.
You good for it?
I always was before, Reacher said. Ask Fisnik.
Fisnik is history, the pale guy said.
Nothing more.
Reacher waited.
Then the pale guy said,
Maybe there's a way I can help you. Although, you got to understand, I would be taking a risk, which would have to be reflected in the price. You comfortable with that scenario?
I guess, Reacher said.
And I have to tell you, I'm pretty much a round figures guy. Can't do 18.9. We would have to call it 20. Then I would take 1,100 off the top as an administration fee. You would get the exact amount you need. You want to hear the interest rates?
I guess, Reacher said again.
Things have moved on since Fisnik's day. We're in an era of innovation now. We operate what they call dynamic pricing. We pitch the rate up or down, depending on supply and demand and things like that, but also on what we think of the borrower. Will he be reliable? Can we trust him? Questions of that nature.
So what am I? Reacher asked. Up or down?
I'm going to start you off way up there at the very top, where the worst risks are. Truth is, I don't like you very much, Arinshevik. I'm not getting a good feeling. You take 20 tonight. You bring me 25 a week from today.
After that, interest continues at 25% a week or part of a week, plus a late fee of $1,000 a day or part of a day. After the first deadline, all sums become payable in full immediately on demand. Refusal or inability to pay on demand may expose you to unpleasant things of various different types. You have to understand that ahead of time. I need to hear you say so in your own words. It's not the kind of thing that can be written down and signed. I have photographs for you to look at.
Terrific, Reacher said. The guy dabbed at his phone. Menus, albums, slideshows, and he handed it over sideways, like a landscape, not a portrait, which was appropriate, because all the subjects of all the pictures were lying down. Mostly they were duct-taped to an iron bedstead, in a room with whitewashed walls gone gray with age and damp. Some had their eyeballs popped out with a spoon, and some had been grazed by an electric saw, deeper and deeper. And some had been burned with a smoothing iron, and some had been drilled with cordless power tools, which were left in the pictures as if in proof, yellow and black, top-heavy and wobbling, their bits two-thirds buried in yielding flesh. Pretty bad. But not the worst things Reacher had ever seen. Maybe the worst things all on one phone, though.
He handed it back. The guy dabbed through his menus again, until they got where he wanted to be. Serious business now.
He said, Do you understand the terms of the contract?
Yes, Reacher said.
Do you agree to them?
Yes, Reacher said.
Bank account.
Reacher gave him Shevik's numbers. The guy typed them in, right there on his phone, and then he dabbed a big green rectangle at the bottom of the screen. The go button.
He said, The money will be in your bank in 20 minutes.
Then he dabbed through more menus and suddenly raised the phone in camera mode and snapped Reacher's picture. He said,
Thank you, Mr. Shevik. A pleasure doing business. I'll see you again in 1 week exactly.
Then he tapped his bristly head with his bone-white finger, the same gesture as before. Something about remembering, some kind of a threatening implication.
Whatever, Reacher thought.
He got up and walked away. Out the door, into the dark. There was a car at the curb. A black Lincoln, with an idling engine and an idling driver behind the wheel, leaning back in his seat, head on the cushion, elbows wide, knees wide,
like limo guys everywhere taking a break. There was a second guy outside the car, leaning on the rear fender. He was dressed the same as the driver, and the guy inside the bar. Black suit, white shirt, black silk tie. Like a uniform. He had his ankles crossed and his arms crossed. He was just waiting. He looked like the guy at the corner table would look after about a month in the sun. White, not luminescent. He had pale hair buzzed close to his scalp and a busted nose and scar tissue on his eyebrows. Not much of a fighter, Reacher thought. Obviously, he got hit a lot. The guy said, "You Shivik?" Reacher said, "Who's asking?" "The people you just borrowed money from." "Sounds like you already know who I am." "We're going to drive you home." "Suppose I don't want you to," Reacher said.
"Part of the deal," the guy said.
"What deal?"
"We need to know where you live."
"Why?"
"Reassurance."
"Look me up."
"We did."
"And?"
"You're not in the book. You don't own real estate."
Reacher nodded. The Sheviks had given up their landline telephone. The title to their house had already passed to the bank. The guy said,
"So we need to pay a personal visit."
Reacher said nothing. The guy asked,
"Is there a Mrs. Shevik?"
"Why?"
"Maybe we should visit a little with her too while we're looking at where you live. We like to keep our customers close. We like to make a family's acquaintance. We find it helpful. Now get in the car."
Reacher shook his head.
"You misunderstand," the guy said. "This is not a choice. It's part of the deal. You borrowed our money."
Your milky white friend inside explained the contract. He went through all the terms in considerable detail. The administration fee, the dynamic pricing, the penalties. At one point, he even introduced visual aids. After which he asked if I accepted the terms of the contract, and I said yes, I did. So at that point, the deal was done. You can't start adding extra stuff afterward, about a ride home and meeting the family. I would have to agree to that ahead of time. A contract is a two-way street, subject to negotiation and agreement. It can't be done unilaterally. That's a basic principle.
You got this smart mouth.
I can only hope, Reacher said. Sometimes I worry I'm just pedantic.
What?
You can offer me a ride, but you can't insist that I take it.
What?
You heard.
Okay. I'm offering you a ride. Last chance. Get in the car.
Say please. The guy paused a long, long moment. He said,
"Please get in the car."
"Okay," Reacher said, "since you asked so nicely."
Chapter 8. About the safest way to transport an unwilling hostage in a passenger car was to make him drive with his seatbelt off. The guys with the Lincoln didn't do that. They opted for a conventional second best instead. They put Reacher in the back, behind the empty front passenger seat, with nothing dead ahead for him to attack. The guy who had done all the talking got in next to him, on the other side, behind the driver, and he sat half sideways, watchful. He said,
"Where to?"
"Turn around," Reacher said. The driver U-turned across the width of the street, bouncing his front right side wheel up the far curb and slapping it down again. "Go straight for 5 blocks," Reacher said. The driver rolled on. He was a smaller version of the first guy, not as pale. Caucasian, for sure, but not blinding. He had the same buzzed hair, golden and glittery. He had a knife scar on the back of his left hand, probably a defensive wound. He had a spidery and fading tattoo snaking out of his right cuff. He had big pink ears, sticking straight out from the sides of his head. Their tires pattered over broken blacktop and patches of cobblestone. After the 5 straight blocks, they came to the 4-way light, where Shevik had waited to cross. They rolled out of the old world and into the new, flat and open terrain, concrete and gravel, wide sidewalks.
It all looked different in the dark. The bus depot was up ahead. Straight on, Reacher said. The driver rolled through the green. They passed the depot. They tracked around, a polite distance behind the high rent districts. Half a mile later, they came to where the bus had turned off the main drag. Take the right, Reacher said, out toward the highway. He saw the in-town two-lane was called Center Street. Then it widened to four lanes and was called a state route number. Then came the giant supermarket. The office parks were up ahead.
Where the hell are we going? The guy in the back said. No one lives out here.
Why I like it, Reacher said. The road was smooth. Their tires hissed over it. There was no traffic up ahead. Maybe something behind them. Reacher didn't know. He couldn't risk a look. He said, Tell me again why you want to meet my wife. The guy in the back said,
We find it helpful.
How?
You pay back a bank loan because you're worried about your credit score and your good name and your standing in the community. But that's all gone for you. You're down in the sewer. What are you worried about now? What's going to make you pay us back?
They passed the office parks. Still no traffic. The auto dealer was up ahead in the distance. A wire fence, ranks of dark shapes, bunting that gleamed gray in the moonlight. Sounds like a threat, Reacher said.
Daughters are good, too.
Still no traffic. Reacher hit the guy in the face. Out of nowhere, a sudden violent explosion of muscle. No warning at all. A pile driver, with all the speed and twist he could muster in the confined space available. The guy's head smashed back into the window frame behind him. A mist of blood from his nose spattered the glass. Reacher reloaded and hit the driver. Same kind of force, same kind of result. Leaning over the seat, a clubbing roundhouse right direct to the guy's ear. The guy's head snapping sideways, bouncing off the glass. Straight into a second jabbing right to the same ear, and a third, which turned the lights out. The guy fell forward on his steering wheel. Reacher balled himself up in the rear footwell. A second later, the car hit the auto dealer's fence at 40 miles an hour. Reacher heard a colossal bang and a banshee screech, and the airbags exploded, and he was crushed against the seat back in front of him, which yielded and collapsed into the deflating airbag ahead of it, just as the car smashed into the first vehicle for sale, on the near end of the long line under the flags and the bunting. The Lincoln hit it hard, head-on into its gleaming flank, and the Lincoln's windshield shattered and its back end came up in the air and crashed back to earth, and the engine stalled out and the car went still and quiet, all except for a loud and furious hiss of steam under the wrecked hood. Reacher unfolded himself and climbed up on the seat again. He had taken all the juddering impacts on the flat of his back. He felt like Shevik had looked on the sidewalk. Shaken up, hurting all over. Regular kind of thing, or worse? He guessed regular. He moved his head, his neck, his shoulders, his legs. Nothing broken, nothing torn. Not too bad. The same could not be said for the other two guys. The driver had been smashed in the face by the airbag, and then in the back of the head by the other guy, who had been thrown forward from the rear compartment like a spear, right out through the shattering windshield, where he still was, folded at the waist over the crumpled hood, face down. His feet were the nearest part of him. He wasn't moving. Neither was the driver. Reacher forced open his door against the screech of distorted metal, and he crawled out, and he forced the door shut again after him. There was no traffic behind them. Nothing up ahead either, except dim twinkling headlights, maybe a mile in the distance. Coming toward them, a minute away, at 60 miles an hour. The vehicle the Lincoln had hit was a minivan, a Ford. It was all stoved in on the side, bent like a banana. It had a banner in the windshield that said, No accidents. The Lincoln itself was a total mess. It was crumpled up like a concertina all the way back to the windshield, like a safety ad in a newspaper, except for the guy draped on top. The headlights up ahead were getting nearer, and now back toward town there were more. The auto dealer's fence was burst open like a cartoon drawing. Raggedy curls of wire curved neatly out the way. as if they had been blown back by the slipstream. The gap was about 8 feet wide. Basically, a whole section was gone. Reacher wondered if the fence had motion sensors, connected to a silent alarm, connected to the police department. Maybe an insurance requirement. Certainly, there was plenty of stuff to steal inside. Time to go. Reacher stepped through the hole in the fence, stiff and sore, bruised and battered, but functioning. He stayed away from the road. Instead, he stumbled along parallel to it, through fields and vacant lots, 50 feet in the dirt, out of lateral headlight range, while cars drove by in the distance, some slow, some fast. Maybe cops, maybe not. He skirted around the blind side of the first office park and the second, and then he changed his angle and headed for the giant supermarket's parking lot, aiming to walk through it and rejoin the main drag where it led out. Gregory got the news more or less immediately from a janitor cleaning up in the emergency room, part of the Ukrainian network. The guy took a smoke break and called it right in. Two of Gregory's men just arrived on gurneys, lights and sirens. One bad, one worse. Both would probably die. There was talk of a car wreck out by the Ford dealer. Gregory called his top boys together, and 10 minutes later they were all assembled around a table in the back room of the taxi company. His right-hand man said, "All we know for sure is earlier this evening, two of our guys deployed to the bar to do an address check on one of the former customers from the Albanian credit operation." "How long does an address check take?" Gregory said. "They must have finished long ago. This must be something else entirely. It's obviously separate. It can't have been the address check itself. Because who the hell lives all the way out by the Ford dealer? No one, that's who. So they let the guy out at his house and noted the address. Maybe he took a photograph. And then they headed over to the Ford dealer afterward. Why? Must have been a reason. And why did they crash? Maybe they were chased in that direction. Or decoyed, then bumped and run off the road. It's pretty lonely out there at night." "You think it was Dino?" "You got to ask. Why those two in particular? Maybe they were followed from right outside the bar." "Which would be appropriate. Because maybe Dino is making a point here. We stole his business. We expected some reaction after all. After he twigged. Maybe he has now. How much of a point is he going to make?" "Maybe this is it," the guy said. "Two men for two men. We keep the loan business. It would be a surrender with honor. He's a realistic man. He doesn't have many options. He can't start the war with the cops watching." Gregory said nothing. The room went quiet. No sound at all. Except muted chatter from the taxi radio in the front office, through the closed door. Just background noise. No one paid any attention to it. If they had, they would have heard a driver calling in to say he had let out an old lady at the supermarket and was going to use his waiting time while she shopped to earn an extra buck by driving a guy home, to the old tract houses east of downtown. The guy was on foot, but he looked reasonably civilized, and he had cash money. Maybe his car had broken down. It was 4 miles there and 4 miles back. He would be done before the old lady was even out of the bakery aisle. No harm, no foul. At that moment, Dino was getting a much earlier and incomplete snapshot of part of the news. It had taken an hour to travel up the chain. It included nothing about the car wreck. Most of the day had been spent disposing of Fiznik and his named accomplice. Reorganization had been left very late, almost an afterthought. A replacement had been sent to the bar to pick up on Fiznik's business. The chosen guy had gotten there a little after 8 o'clock in the evening. Immediately he had seen Ukrainian muscle in the street, guarding the place. A town car and two men. He had snuck around to the bar's rear fire door and snuck a look inside. A Ukrainian guy was sitting at Fiznik's table in the far back corner, talking to a big guy who looked disheveled and poor, obviously a customer. At that point, the chosen replacement regrouped and retreated. He phoned it in. The guy he told called another guy, who called another guy, and so on. Because bad news traveled slowly. An hour later, Dino heard about it. He called his top boys together in the lumberyard. He said,
"There are two possible scenarios. Either the thing about the police commissioner's list was true, and they opportunistically and treacherously used the disruption to muscle in on our money-lending business, or it wasn't true, and they planned this thing all along, and in fact tricked us into clearing the way for them."
His right-hand man said,
"I suppose we must hope it was the former."
Dino was quiet for a long spell.
Then he said, "I'm afraid we must pretend it was the former. We have no choice. We can't start a war, not now. We'll have to let them keep the money-lending business. We have no practical way to get it back. But we'll surrender it with honor. It must be two for two. We can't be seen to do less than that. Kill two of their men, and we'll call it even."
His right-hand man asked, "Which two?"
"I don't care," Dino said.
Then he changed his mind.
"No. Choose them carefully," he said. "Let's try to find an advantage."
Chapter 9. Reacher got out of the taxi at the Shevik house and walked up the narrow concrete path. The door opened before he could ring the bell. Shevik stood there, with the light behind him and his phone in his hand.
"The money came through an hour ago," he said. "Thank you."
"Welcome," Reacher said.
"You're late. We thought maybe you weren't coming back."
"I had to take a minor detour."
"Where?"
"Let's go inside," Reacher said. "We need to talk." This time they used the living room, the photographs on the wall, the amputated television. The Sheviks took the armchairs, and Reacher sat on the love seat. He said, "It happened pretty much like it happened with you and Fiznik, except the guy snapped my picture, which might be a good thing in the end. Your name, my face. A little confusion never hurts. But if I was a real client, I wouldn't have liked it. Not one little bit. It would have felt like a bony finger on my shoulder. It would have made me feel vulnerable." Then I got outside and there was more. Two guys who wanted to drive me home, to see where I lived and who I lived with. My wife, if I had one. Which was another bony finger. Maybe a whole bony hand.
"What happened?"
"The three of us negotiated a different arrangement, not linked in any way to your name or address. In fact, fairly confusing as to exactly what took place. I wanted an element of mystery about it. Their bosses will suspect a message, but they won't be sure who from. They'll think the Albanians, most likely. Not you, certainly."
"What happened to the men?"
"They were part of the message, as in, this is America. Don't send an asshole who last time out was seventh on the undercard in some basement fight club in Kiev. At least take it seriously. Show some respect."
"They saw your face."
"They won't remember. They had an accident. They got all banged up. Their memories will be missing an hour or two. Retrograde amnesia, they call it. Fairly common after physical trauma. If they don't die first, that is."
"So, everything's okay?"
"Not really," Reacher said.
"What else?"
"These are not reasonable people."
"We know."
"How are you going to pay their money back?" They didn't answer. "You need 25 grand a week from right now. You can't be late. They showed me pictures, too. Fiznik's can't have been worse. You need some kind of a plan." Shevik said,
"A week is a long time."
"Not really," Reacher said again. Mrs. Shevik said,
"Something good might happen."
Nothing more. Reacher said, "You really need to tell me what it is you're waiting for."
It was about their daughter, inevitably. Mrs. Shevik's gaze roamed the pictures on the wall as she told the story. Their daughter's name was Margaret, shortened since childhood to Meg. She had been a bright, happy infant, full of charm and energy. She loved other children. She loved kindergarten. She loved elementary school. She loved to read and write and draw. She smiled and chattered all the time. She could persuade anyone to do anything. She could have sold ice to the Eskimos, her mother said. She loved middle school just as much, and junior high, and high school. She was popular. Everyone liked her. She put on plays and sang in the choir and ran track and swam. She got her diploma, but she didn't go to college. Her book learning was good, but not her main strength. She was a people person. She needed to be out and about, smiling, chatting, charming folks, bending them to her will, if truth be told. She liked a purpose. She got an entry-level job in the spokesperson business, and she bounced around town from one PR office to another, doing whatever the local establishments had a budget for. She worked hard and made her name and got promoted, and by the time she was 30, she was making more than her dad ever had as a machinist. 10 years later, at 40, she was still doing well, but she felt her trajectory had slowed. Her acceleration had been blunted. She could see her ceiling above her. She would sit at her desk and think, is this it? No, she decided. She wanted one last big score, bigger than big. She was in the wrong place, she knew. She would have to move. San Francisco, probably, where the tech money was, where complicated things needed explaining. Sooner or later, she would have to go there. Or New York. But she dithered. Time passed. Then, amazingly, San Francisco came to her, in a manner of speaking. Later she learned there was a perpetual ongoing game, stoked up by real estate people and tech sector accountants, in which the prize was to guess correctly about where the next but one Silicon Valley would be, in order to get in early. For some reason, her hometown checked all the secret boxes. Regenerating, the right kind of people, the right buildings, and power, and internet speed. The first advance scouts were already sniffing around. Meg got a friend of a friend introduction to a guy who knew a guy, who arranged an interview with the founder of a brand new venture. They met in a downtown coffee shop. He was a 25-year-old fresh off the plane from California. Some kind of a foreign-born computer genius, with some new thing to do with medical software and apps on people's phones. Mrs. Shevik admitted she had never been exactly sure what the product was, except she knew it was the type of thing that made folks rich. Meg was offered the job, senior vice president for communications and local affairs. It was a fledgling, ink-not-dry startup company, so the salary wasn't great. Not much more than she was already making. But there was a whole giant package of benefits. Stock options, a huge pension plan, a gold-plated health plan, a European coupe to drive. Plus weird San Francisco stuff like free pizza and candy and massages. She liked all of it. But the stock options were by far the biggest deal. One day, she could be a billionaire. Literally. That was how these things happened. At first, it went pretty well. Meg did great work keeping the drums beating, and two or three times in the first year it looked like they might make it to the top of the hill. But they didn't. Not quite. The second year was the same. Still glossy and glamorous and cutting edge and the next big thing. But nothing actually happened. The third year was worse. Investors got nervous. The cash spigot was turned way down. But they hung in, lean and mean. They rented two floors of their building. No more pizza or candy. The massage tables were folded up and put away. They worked harder than ever, side by side in cramped quarters, still determined, still confident. Then, Meg got cancer. Or more accurately, she found out she'd had cancer for about the last 6 months. She had been too busy for doctor visits. She thought the weight she was losing was from working too hard. But no. It was a bad diagnosis. It was a virulent type, and it was fairly advanced. The only ray of hope was a bunch of new treatments. They were exotic and expensive, but their trials had been promising. They seemed to work. Their success rate was climbing. No other option, the doctors said. Calendars were cleared, and Meg was booked in for her first session the very next morning, which was when the problems started. Mrs. Shevick said,
"There was a glitch with her insurance. Her account number wouldn't run. She was prepping for chemo, and people were running in and out asking her full name and date of birth and social security number. It was a nightmare. They had the insurance company on the phone, and no one knew what was going on. They could see her history, and they knew she was a customer. But the code wouldn't authorize. It threw up an error message. They said it was just a computer thing. No big deal. They said it would be fixed the next day. But the hospital said we couldn't wait. They had us sign a form. It said we would cover the bill if the insurance didn't come through. They said it was just a technicality. They said computer things happened all the time. They said everything would get straightened out.
I'm guessing everything didn't, Reacher said.
The weekend came along, which was two more sessions, and then it was Monday, and then we found out.
Found out what? Reacher asked, although he felt he could guess. Mrs. Shevick shook her head and sighed and flapped her hand in front of her face, as if she couldn't form the words, as if she was all done talking. Her husband leaned forward, with his elbows on his knees, and he continued the tale.
"Their third year," he said, when their investors got nervous. It was even worse than they knew. It was worse than anyone knew. The boss was keeping secrets. From everyone. Meg included. Behind the scenes, the whole thing was falling apart. He wasn't paying the bills. Not a dime. He didn't renew the company health plan. He didn't pay the premium. He just ignored it.
Meg's number wouldn't run because the policy was canceled. On her fourth day of treatment, we found out she was uninsured. Not her fault, Reacher said, surely. It was some kind of fraud or breach of contract. There must be a remedy.
There are two, Shevick said. One is a government no-fault fund, and the other is an insurance industry no-fault fund. Both of them set up for this specific reason. Naturally, we ran straight to them. Right away, they got to work on how to apportion responsibility between them, and as soon as that's done, they're going to refund everything we've spent so far, and then take care of everything else going forward. We expect a decision any day.
But you can't pause Meg's treatment.
She needs so much.
Two or three sessions a day. Chemo, radiation, care and feeding, all kinds of scans, all kinds of lab work. She can't get welfare. Technically, she's still employed, technically with a decent salary. No one in the press is interested. Where's the story? Kid needs something. Parents willing to pay. Where's the punchline?
Maybe we shouldn't have signed that paper. Maybe other doors would have opened. But we did sign the paper. Too late now. Obviously, the hospital wants to get paid. This is not emergency room stuff. It can't be written off. Their machines cost $1 million. They have to buy actual physical crystals of radioactive stuff. They want the money in advance. It's what happens in cases like these. Cash on the barrelhead. Nothing happens before. Nothing we can do about it. All we can do is hang in until someone else steps up. Could be tomorrow morning. We have 7 chances before the week is over.
You need a lawyer, Reacher said.
Can't afford one.
There's probably an important principle in there somewhere. You could probably get one pro bono.
We have three of that kind already, Shevik said. They're working on the public interest aspect. Bunch of kids. They're poorer than we are.
Seven chances before the week is over, Reacher said. Sounds like a country song.
It's all we got.
I guess it almost qualifies as a plan.
Thank you.
Do you have a plan B?
Not as such.
You could try lying low. I'll be long gone. The photograph they took will be no good to them.
You'll be gone?
I can't stay anywhere a week.
They have our name. I'm sure we can be traced. There must be old paperwork still around. One level down from the phone book.
Tell me about the lawyers.
They're working for free, Shevik said. How good can they be?
Sounds like another country song. Shevik didn't answer. Mrs. Shevik looked up.
There are three of them, she said. Three nice young men, from a public law project, paying their dues. Good intentions, I'm sure. But the law moves slow.
Reacher said, Plan B could be the police. A week from now, if the other thing hasn't happened yet, you could head over to the station house and tell them the story. Shevik asked,
How well would they protect us?
I guess not very, Reacher said.
And for how long?
Not very, Reacher said again.
We would be burning our boats, Mrs. Shevik said. If the other thing hasn't happened yet, then we need those people more than ever. Who else could we turn to when the next bill comes in?
Going to the police would leave us with no access to anything. Okay, Reacher said. No police. Seven chances.
I'm sorry about Meg. I really am.
I really hope she makes it. He stood up and felt large in the small boxy space. Shevik said,
Are you going?
Reacher nodded. I'll get a hotel in town, he said. Maybe I'll swing by in the morning to say so long before I hit the road. If I don't, it was a pleasure meeting you. I wish you the best of luck with your troubles. He left them there, sitting quiet in the half-empty room. He let himself out the front door, and he walked down the narrow concrete path to the street, and onward past parked cars and dark, silent houses. And when he hit the main drag, he turned toward town. Chapter 10 There was a particular block on the west side of Center Street that had two restaurants side by side fronting on the sidewalk, and a third on the north side of the block, and a fourth on the south side, and a fifth in back, fronting on the next street over. All five were doing well. They were always busy, always buzzing, always talked about. They were the city's gourmet quarter, right there, packed tight. The produce trucks and the linen services loved it. One stop, five customers. Deliveries were easy.
So were collections.
It was a Ukrainian block, being west of center. They came by for their protection money, regular as clockwork. One stop, five customers. They loved it. They came late in the evening, when the registers were full, before anyone else got paid. They would walk in, always two guys, always together, dark suits and black silk ties and pale blank faces. Nothing was ever said. Technically, it would have been difficult to prove illegality. In fact, nothing had been said, even back at the beginning, many years before, except a subjective aesthetic opinion, and then a concerned and sympathetic murmur.
Nice place you've got here. Be a shame if anything happened to it. Polite conversation.
After which, $100 bill was offered, but was greeted with a shake of the head, until a second $100 was added, which was greeted with a nod. After the first encounter, the cash was usually left in an envelope, usually at the maitre d' station. Usually it was handed over without a word. Technically, a voluntary activity. No overt demands had been made. No offers had been solicited. $1,000 for a stroll around the block. Almost legal. Nice work if you could get it. Naturally, there was competition for the gig. Naturally, it was won by the big dogs, the senior lieutenants, looking for a quiet life. That particular evening, they didn't get one. They had parked their car on the curb on Center Street, and they had started with the two establishments right there, fronting on the sidewalk, and then they had worked the block counterclockwise, making their third stop on the north side, and their fourth on the back street, and their fifth on the south side, after which they kept on going, intending to turn the last corner and thereby complete the square and arrive back at their car. All of which they did, without noticing a couple of important things. Up ahead on the next block was a tow truck, facing away, parked, but idling with its reversing lights showing. And about level with it, on the opposite sidewalk, was a man in a black raincoat, walking fast toward them. What did that mean? They didn't ask. They were senior lieutenants, looking for a quiet life. They split up around the hood of their car, the passenger going one way and the driver going the other. They pulled their doors, not exactly synchronized, but close. They glanced around, still standing, one last time, chins up, in case anyone was in doubt who owned the block. They missed the tow truck start to move, slowly, backward, straight toward them. They missed the man in the raincoat step off the far sidewalk at an angle, straight toward them. They slid into their seats, butts, knees, feet. But before they could get their doors closed, a shape had peeled out of the shadows on one side, and the man in the raincoat had arrived on the other, both with small semi-automatic .22-caliber pistols in their hands, both pistols with long, fat suppressors screwed to their muzzles, which went blat, 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 as multiple rounds were fired close range into the seated heads, which were right there at waist level. Both guys in the car fell forward and inward, away from the guns. Their shattered heads bumped together, near the clock on the dash, as if they were fighting for space. Then their doors were slammed shut. The tow truck backed up. The shape from the shadows and the man in the raincoat ran to meet it. The driver jumped out. Together they got the car craned up. All three jumped back in the tow truck. They drove off, slow and sedate. A common sight. A disabled vehicle. Undignified, being dragged backward through the streets on its front wheels, with its ass way up in the air. Nothing was visible above the window line. Gravity was making sure of that. By then both guys would be piled in the footwells, limp and floppy. Rigor was still some hours away. They drove direct to the crushing plant. They unhooked the car and left it on a patch of oil-soaked dirt. A huge backhoe drove over. Instead of a bucket, it had giant forklift spears on the front. It lifted the car and drove it to the crusher. It set it down on a steel floor in a three-sided box not much bigger than the car itself. It backed away. The box's fourth side folded up into place. Its top folded down. Engines roared and hydraulics clanked, and the box's sides crushed inward, relentlessly, grating, groaning, scraping, tearing, 150 tons of force behind each one. Then they stopped and wheezed back to where they had started, and a piston pushed out a cube of crushed metal about a yard on a side. It rested for a moment on a heavy iron grill for leaking fluids to drain away. Gasoline and oil and brake fluid and whatever it was in the air conditioner, plus other fluids on this occasion. Then a brother to the first backhoe came along. Instead of forklift spears, it had a claw. It picked up the cube and drove it away and stacked it in a wall of 100 other cubes. Only then did the man in the raincoat call Dino. Total success. 2 for 2. Honor even. They had effectively traded the moneylending for the gourmet quarter, which was a short-term loss, but maybe a long-term gain. It was a foot in the door. It was a landing zone that could be first defended and then expanded. Above all, It was proof the map could be redrawn. Dino went to bed happy.
Reacher had been glad of the lucky taxi in the supermarket parking lot, partly for the time it had saved. He had figured the Sheviks would be worried, and partly for the effort it had saved, especially right then, all bruised and battered. But it had done him no favors. It had let him stiffen up. His walk back to town was painful. His sense of direction told him the best route was the one he already knew. Back past the bar, past the bus depot, and onward to Center Street, where the chain hotels would be clustered, maybe a little ways south, all within a block or two. He knew cities. He walked faster than he wanted to and paid attention to his posture, head up, shoulders back, arms loose, back straight, finding all the aches and pains, fighting them, chasing them out, yielding nothing. There was no one in the street outside the bar. No parked car, no insolent muscle. Reacher backed up and looked in the grimy window, past the dusty harps and shamrocks. The pale guy was still at the table in the far corner, still luminescent. There was no one with him, no hapless customer down in the sewer. Reacher moved on, getting looser, walking better. He came out of the old blocks at the four-way light and walked on past the bus depot, watching the sky ahead for the glow of neon, for skyline buildings with lit-up names, which could be banks or insurance companies or local TV, or hotels, or all of the above. There were six of them in total, six towers standing proud, the downtown cluster, a brave statement. Most of the glow was to his half left, which was south of west. He decided to cut the corner and head straight there. He made a left and crossed Center Street into a thoroughfare that in its bones was no better than the street with the bar, but a lot of money had been spent on it, and it was all gussied up. The streetlights were working. The brick was clean. No establishments were boarded up. Most of them were offices of one kind or another. Not necessarily commercial ventures, mostly worthy causes, municipal services, and so on. A family counselor, the local HQ of a political party. All were dark, except for one, across the street at the far end of the block. It was lit up bright. It had been rebuilt like a traditional old storefront. It had a sign in the window, printed on the glass, in big letters, in an old-fashioned style, like the Marine Corps typewriters of Reacher's youth. The sign said, "The Public Law Project." "There are three of them," Mrs. Shevick had said, "from a public law project. Three nice young men." Behind the window was a modern blonde wood workspace, crammed with old-fashioned khaki and white paperwork. There were three guys sitting at desks. Young, certainly. Reacher couldn't tell if they were nice. He wasn't prepared to venture an opinion. They were all dressed the same, in tan chino pants and blue button-down shirts. Reacher crossed the street. Up close, he saw what were presumably their names, printed on the glass of the door. Same typewriter style, but smaller. The names were Julian Harvey Wood, Gino Vettoretto, and Isaac Mahay Byford, which Reacher thought was a whole lot of names for just three guys. They all had a lot of letters after their names, all kinds of doctoral degrees, one from Stanford Law, one from Harvard, one from Yale. He pulled the door and stepped inside. Chapter 11. All three guys looked up, surprised. One was dark, one was fair, and one was in the middle. They all looked to be in their late 20s. They all looked tired. Hard work, late nights, pizza and coffee. Like law school all over again. The dark one said, "Can we help you?" "Which one are you?" Reacher said. "Julian, Gino, or Isaac?"
"I'm Gino."
"Pleased to meet you, Gino," Reacher said. "Any chance you know an old couple named Shevick?"
"Why?"
"I just spent a little time with them. I became familiar with their troubles. They told me they had three lawyers from a public law project. I'm wondering if that's you."
In fact, I'm assuming it is. I'm asking myself how many public law projects a city this size could support. The fair one said, if there are clients, then obviously we can't discuss their case. Which one are you?
I'm Julian.
The neither dark nor fair one said, and I'm Isaac.
I'm Reacher. Pleased to meet you all.
Are the Sheviks your clients?
Yes, they are,
Gino said, so we can't talk about them.
Make it like a hypothetical example. In a case like theirs, is either one of the no-fault funds likely to pay out within the next 7 days?
Isaac said,
we really shouldn't discuss it.
Just theoretically, Reacher said, as an abstract illustration.
It's complicated, Julian said.
By what?
I mean, theoretically speaking, such a case would start out simple. But then it would get very complicated if family members stepped in to act as guarantors. Such a move would downgrade the urgency. I mean that literally. It would mark it down a grade. The no-fault funds are dealing with tens of thousands of cases, maybe hundreds of thousands. If they know for sure a patient is currently receiving care anyway, they assign a different code, like a lower grade. Not exactly bottom of the pile, but more like back burner, while more urgent stuff is handled first.
So the Sheviks made a mistake by signing the paper.
We can't discuss the Sheviks, Gino said. There are confidentiality issues.
Theoretically, Reacher said. Hypothetically. Would it be a mistake for hypothetical parents to sign the paper?
Of course it would, Isaac said. Think about it from a bureaucrat's point of view. The patient is getting treatment. The bureaucrat doesn't care how. All he knows is there's no negative PR liability for him. So he can take his sweet time. The hypothetical parents should have stood firm and said no. They should have refused to sign.
I guess they couldn't bring themselves to do that.
I agree. It would have been tough under the circumstances. But it would have worked. The bureaucrat would have been obliged to get his checkbook out, right there and then, no choice.
It's an education thing, Gino said. People need to know their rights ahead of time. It can't be done in the moment. It's your kid lying on a gurney. There's too much emotion.
Reacher asked, is anything going to happen in the next 7 days?
No one answered,
which Reacher figured was an answer in itself. Eventually, Julian said,
the problem is, now they have time to argue.
The government fund is taxpayer money. The legislation is unpopular. Therefore, the government will want the insurance fund to pay. The insurance fund is shareholder money. Bonuses depend on it. Therefore, the insurance fund will bounce it back to the government, over and over again, as long as it takes.
For what?
For the patient to die, Isaac said.
That's the big prize for the insurance fund. Because then we're into a whole other argument. The surrogate contractual relationship was between the no-fault fund and the deceased. What is there to reimburse?
The deceased spent no money. Her care was funded by the generosity of relatives, which happens all the time. Medical donations between family members are so common, the IRS has a whole separate category. But it's not like buying stock in a corporation. You don't benefit from an eventual upside. There's a clue in the name. It's a donation. It's a gift freely given. It doesn't get reimbursed, especially not by and to parties who weren't even in the original voided agreement. It's a matter of legal principle. Precedents are unclear. It could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
So nothing in the next 7 days.
We'd be happy with the next 7 years.
They're deep into loan sharks.
The bureaucrat doesn't care how.
Do you?
Julian said, our clients won't let us anywhere near their financial business.
Reacher nodded. He said, they don't want you to burn their boats.
Their words exactly, Gino said. They feel busting the loan sharks would leave them with no access to money in the future, should they need it, which experience tells them they probably will.
Reacher asked, do they have other legal remedies anywhere?
Hypothetically, Julian said, the obvious strategy would be a civil suit against the delinquent employer. Absolutely couldn't fail. But obviously, never pursued in a case like this, because the cause of action itself will have already exposed the defendant as a fraud, thereby ruining him, thereby giving the successful plaintiff no assets to collect against. Nothing else they can do. We petitioned the court on their behalf, Gino said, but they stopped reading where it says she's getting treatment anyway. Okay, Reacher said. Let's hope for the best. Someone just told me a week is a long time. Thanks for your help. Much appreciated. He backed away and pushed the door and stepped out to the street. He stopped on the corner to fine-tune his direction. A right and a left, he thought. That should do it. Behind him, he heard the door open again. He heard footsteps on the sidewalk. He turned and saw Isaac walking toward him, the one who was neither dark nor fair. He was 5'9", maybe, and solid as a bull seal. His pants were cuffed. He said, I'm Isaac, remember? Isaac Mahay Byford, Reacher said. J.D. from Stanford Law. Tough school. Congratulations. But I'm guessing you're from the other coast originally. Boston, he said. My dad was a cop there. You remind me of him a little bit. He noticed things, too. Now you're making me feel old. Are you a cop? I was, Reacher said, once upon a time. In the army. Does that count? It might, Isaac said. You could give me some advice. About what? How did you come to know the Sheviks? I helped him out of a jam this morning. He hurt his knee. I walked him home. They told me the story. His wife calls me now and then. They don't have many friends. I know what they're doing for money. Sooner or later, they're going to run out of room. I think they already have, Reacher said, or they will in 7 days. I have a crazy personal theory, Isaac said. About what? Or maybe I'm just deluding myself. About what? Reacher asked again. The last thing Julian said, about the civil suit against the employer. No point pursuing it because the assets are worthless. Usually good advice. Good advice in this case, too, I'm sure. Except actually, I'm not sure. Why not? The guy was famous here for a spell. Everyone was talking about him. Ironically, Meg Shevick did a great job with the PR. Lots of tech sector mythology, lots of young entrepreneur stuff, lots of positive immigration spin about how he came to this country with nothing and made such a success. But I heard negative things, too. Here and there. Fragments, gossip, bits and pieces, all unconnected. All hearsay and uncorroborated, too, but from people who should know. I became weirdly obsessed with figuring out how all those random pieces fit together behind the public image. There seemed to be three main themes. He was all about himself. He was ethically challenged. And he seemed to have way more money than he should. My crazy personal theory was that if you joined the dots the one and only way they could be joined, then logically you were forced to conclude he was skimming off the top, which would have been easy for an ethically challenged person. There was a tsunami of cash back then. It was insane. I think it was irresistible. I think he shoveled millions of dollars of investor money under his own personal mattress. Which would explain how the company went down so fast, Reacher said. It had no reserves. They had been stolen. The balance sheet was all messed up. The point is that money might still be there, Isaac said, or most of it, or some of it, still under his mattress. In which case, the civil suit would be worth it. Against him personally, not against the company. Reacher said nothing. Isaac said, the lawyer in me tells me it's 100-1. But I would hate to see the Sheviks go down without checking it out. But I don't know how to do it. That's what I need advice about. A real law firm would hire a private investigator. They would locate the guy and dig through his records. 2 days later, we would know for sure. But the project doesn't have the budget, and we don't get paid enough to chip in ourselves. Why would they need to locate the guy?
Has he disappeared?
We know he's still in town, but he's laying low. I doubt if I could find him by myself. He's very smart. And if I'm right, he's also very rich. Not a good combination. It lengthens the odds.
What's his name?
Maxim Trulenko, Isaac said. He's Ukrainian.
Chapter 12. Gregory heard the first whispers out of the gourmet quarter an hour after the events there took place. His bookkeeper called to say his nightly report would be delayed because he was still waiting on two particular bagmen who hadn't checked in yet. Gregory asked which two, and the bookkeeper told him the guys who did the five restaurants. At first, Gregory thought nothing of it. They were grown-ups. Then his right-hand man